Can you positively affect U.S. election results through graphic design? My guest today thinks you can. Hey, welcome to Growing a Fruitful Brand, where we discuss how to create and grow a brand that makes the world a better place for you, your customers, and your employees. I'm Ben Luters, founder and art director of Fruitful Design and Strategy. My guest today is our longtime friend and design inspiration, Drew Davies. Through his design consultancy, Oxide, he has helped create some of the strongest, most recognizable brands in the Midwest, including the Metro Transit rebrand and the all-new Kiewit Luminarium branding. But it's Drew's heart for civic-minded design that we want to explore today, including his recent work on the new Nebraska license plates and his tireless efforts with the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, helping to improve the design of ballots, voter information materials, and more. Drew, it's an honor to have you in the studio.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Drew, I've known you for how long now? I feel like it's been like 15 years, 10 years, something like that.
It's probably 15 plus now.
That's crazy. How long has Oxide been in existence?
Since 2001. So we're 22 years now. In one form or another.
That's crazy. It's almost older than me. Okay, maybe not. Maybe not quite.
Close.
So, Drew, we've already kind of given it away. You've had an amazing impact in what we call, what you call, I should say, civic-minded design. And when have you always been civic-minded? Like, when did that passion start for you?
Yeah, you know, yes is the short answer. When I started Oxide, one of the things that I cared about was how does anyone of us use our skills to give back in some way, right? So how do we not just run a design firm that designs cool beer labels? I love designing a beer label.
I like that too.
The next person. But, you know, how do we use some of those skills for good, right? And this is a topic we've been discussing in the design field for years and years. So I didn't come up with that idea, but it always felt really strong to me. Like I have these skills. I definitely want to design cool things, but I also want to use those skills that we can change our environment, make our community better and whatnot. And so since day one at Oxide, we set a goal and you almost always hit it of 50% of our work being either donated or discounted to various community-based organizations, places that needed help, nonprofits, and eventually that sort of moved its way into the space of election and ballot design where we did a lot of that work. So it's been a longstanding general idea. And then it, because of how much I cared about the community and making Omaha and Nebraska a better place, it was a natural transition into what I've started calling civic-minded design. This idea that you're not just doing work for nonprofits, but you're doing work that feels like it's contributing broadly to the greater good of the space you're in.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about specifically your work with the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. When did that start? And can you kind of just talk about, you know, some of the different things that you've gotten to do with them?
Yeah. Get settled in, grab some coffee.
Yeah, where's my coffee? So like the one episode I don't have a drink.
Right.
I
know. This is a long story I'll make short for you. In 2000, you may recall the Hanging Chad incident of Florida.
I'm glad you brought that up.
In the elections, it was a hotly contested election between two people we've long since forgotten about. I think their names were Al Gore and George Bush.
This is really dating us. A lot of our listeners have never heard of these people.
Yes, look those two people.
Maybe an ancient history book, but yeah.
But what happened is, the short story is that in Florida, there were a variety of really ballot design mishaps that caused some scenarios to happen where it was clear that a whole bunch of people thought they had voted one way and ended up voting a different way because the ballot was designed so poorly. If you can believe that's a thing. Everybody look this up online if you haven't heard of it. It turns out it was designed that poorly. And it's partially because election officials in each county at that point in time, without any help from the outside, were essentially left to design their own ballots.
Oh, my goodness.
These are not people, obviously, that we expected to have design.
Isn't this the classic thing they say that you don't notice design until it's, like, bad, right? Like, good design goes unnoticed, but then suddenly it's like design is at the center of, like, the world's biggest, you know, story and issue in 2000.
Right, and that's what happened. And at that point in time, the U.S. government stepped in. They passed the Help America Vote Act, which established the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, the EAC, which started a process of wanting to build essentially best practices for ballot design and the materials around voting, polling place signage, and the like.
I wonder if a lot of people even realize that, like, every state has kind of their own way of doing this, right? It's not like everyone is using the exact same system. And so that's the whole point of this, is like trying to create kind of guidelines, best practices that we can all at least be playing off of a similar template.
Right. And before this point, there was none of that. And so you're exactly correct. Every state, and realistically almost every county in every state, was in charge of all of the elements, even of design, around what they were doing. Now, the manufacturers helped them a bit with the baseline of a ballot design, per se, but they were really left out in the wilderness to do a lot of that work.
It's like,
right?
A designer's like nightmare, by the way. It's like, hey, here's this brand, but you know what? Everyone gets their own brand book.
Yeah,
and I think it's going to be fine.
Yeah, do it.
And a lot of them aren't designers. So anyways, I know this is very design-centric, but you can see how this is very important. This is why we're always talking about how design is the most important thing.
Yes, indeed. So the EAC contracted with AIGA, the National Design Organization, a set of federal best practices for this. They involved lots and lots of people. The way I got involved was, I was the president of the Nebraska chapter of AIGA at the time. Mm. Our Secretary of State, God bless him, John Gale, had seen that this was happening, raised his hand at a conference at one point in time to volunteer the state of Nebraska to be pilot test for some of the ballot designs that were being worked up at the time.
Wow.
Because it was an AIGA project and I was the president of the time, I got wind of it and was able to volunteer my and Oxide services to help.
What year was that?
That was 2006.
Okay. Yeah. It was the year I moved here.
And so I and the team at Oxide got engaged in helping to design the prototype ballots, running that pilot test, and then continuing to build out the best practices document as we went. It was adopted by the EAC in 2007, and by the time the project was done, the 50 or so people that had been working on it had all kind of gotten whittled away and left and stormed off and disappeared and whatnot, and the team of us at Oxide were some of the last people standing, is what ended up
being. Were you tempted to storm off at any point?
It's hard, sloggy work, and it's the kind of project that you still see designers in school today taking on, and they think, oh, this is an easy solve. Look, there's a ballot that's broken.
Just design it good.
I will just design it good.
Yeah.
Right? And we, all of us, went in with that mentality. This, we'll have this solved in 3 months, then we'll move on to IRS forms, or, you know.
And we'll move on to throwing all those away.
Right. 15 years later, I feel like now we've made, you know, incremental progress at best. But we built this document.
Drew, you're really just in it for the money, though.
Yeah.
Right? It's really money, I'm sure, that's kept you in the game.
Yep. It's all the government dollars that come in on it. So they adopted this document that we built. And I assumed at the time even that what they'd do is they'd take this big 400-page tome that we built, they'd file it right next to the Ark of the Covenant in whatever that warehouse was, and then we'd all just go on to doing something different. So what I took on as one of the last people standing was to become an advocate for those best practices, because really none of these county and state officials, as we mentioned, were used to using or following any kind of best practices, and they didn't have any design guidance at all, so they didn't even know what this document was. So my job at that point in time was to go out and advocate for, hey, you really want to use these rules. They help you solve these problems. We're here for you. The problem was, I can say now, in hindsight, we built a document that was so design wonky that they still really couldn't use it. So we laid out these specs. You and I, we love them. They're these nuancey, like, set type at 14 point, you know, tracked out at 20, letting 16, et cetera. Like,
I love it. I love it. Keep going,
rules,
Drew.
Et cetera, et cetera. So we built, there's 100, 200 pages in the document that are all that kind of wonky stuff. Well, guess what? If you don't have any design training, you can't use that information. Like, it's just gobbledygook, right?
Right.
So the good news was we figured out pretty easily that that was the case. And so I, with a couple other people, started whittling all of this 400-page document down into a cheat sheet. And it ended up being, at one point, literally a one-page top 10 cheat sheet guideline for non-designers. Here's the rules you should follow to build, to help make your ballots way better. Mm. And literally the rules are things like, don't make the font too small. They had to be that, they had to be that little, right? Like,
right.
If you're going to use color, don't use it for decoration. Use it to mean something. So if you use blue on one item on a ballot, make all the items that are like that item blue.
Wow.
Don't make all those items, you know, right.
So how wildly different are ballots?
They're pretty widely different in certainly one way. The only reason they're reined in a bit is that there's really 3 to 4 major election vendors, the ones that manufacture the ballot printers, the ballot counters, ballot sorters, and they also then, part of their system is providing you the ballots with some level of software templating around how those ballots go. So there is a little bit of a thread where lots of ballots are somewhat similar because there's only 3 or 4 manufacturers making and designing at least the templates for all of those ballots.
So why didn't you just, like, you know, design, this is the designer in me, you know, thinking about this, but like, why didn't you just design an InDesign template, like the one template to rule them all,
right.
And you just sell it to those guys that make the things, and problem solved, and we can all go home, and all the best people will always win elections.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, that's exactly what we did. We found out 2 things. One, the ballot design software that comes with each of these major manufacturers that the county officials were using to, like, put in the data, who's running on the ballot, how do I want to, can I move some blocks around, what do I, you know, can I make this typeface bold? It was like working on an Atari 2600 to build a layout. Like, it's not InDesign.
It's
it's like PageMaker 1.0, maybe. It's probably not.
For the non-designers listening, InDesign is basically, it's like, you know, Word, I guess, for designers, where you're laying out, you know, pages and, yeah.
Right. So no template we could give them would work with their software. It's the short answer. And it turns out there was some pushback. We're still kind of working on this. Each of the election vendors that manufacture all this hardware and the ballots, part of their business model is based around the proprietary nature of what they're selling. And so the concept of what amounts to open source best practices design is kind of antithetical to the way their business practice works. And so it isn't necessarily in their best interest to say, yeah, we'll scrap everything that's uniquely ours that we own the IP of and use this, even if it's the best possible way of going about this. You know, they, as for-profit entities, they have to balance 2 things. One is it better for voters? And the other is, does it make enough profit that we can run this company? And so there's still an ongoing tension about that in terms of where, you know, when and where they implement open source things that are available to all of their competitors to also implement, and how they have to factor that into their business model.
That's so interesting. I wonder, you know, for myself, I guess I didn't even really think about the fact that there's, like, for-profit, you know, businesses that are at the heart of these things. You just assume, like, oh, I don't know, it just, like, you know, happens in Washington somewhere and it just gets handed down from on high, and, you know, maybe to Drew, and then he hands it out, and, like, that's it, you know. But that's really an interesting tension. And I'm sure as a business owner, you kind of can at least understand what they're trying to do.
Right.
But did you find that frustrating? How did you're still in the game, right? So, like, you still haven't walked away. I'm sure there was a lot of frustrations throughout there. Like, how was that process for you?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was definitely frustrating early on. That was when we all went in starry-eyed thinking, this is a design problem. It has a design solution. We'll be done, you know, whatnot. And it turns out there's vendors, there's, you know, every one of these counties and states in terms of their elections process is woefully underfunded. So they don't have any resources to actually change anything at all. they operate in an environment where if it isn't broke, you don't fix it, because if you change anything, you open yourself up to the possibility of lawsuits and complaints and whatnot, because you've messed with the whole system. So it's ingrained in the culture not to rock the boat, generally speaking.
Right.
And they're always understaffed, so they don't have enough people to think this through. It's part of why this aforementioned 2000 debacle down in Florida happened. Like, not nearly enough people. They don't have funding to hire the number of people that should be running an election.
Sure.
So they're all just running around putting out the closest fire they can.
The hanging chads.
You know? Right. And so it was wildly frustrating up front. And then as I kept kind of slogging through it, every one of those challenges makes perfect sense. Like, that's not someone being mean or evil. That's just another cog in the way our elections are run that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
And we can work on solving those problems as well. But these aren't, you know, no one's actively sabotaging the process.
Right.
Just that there are a lot of moving parts. You know, we have a somewhat complex election system here in the United States, partially based on the fact that it's run essentially independently from every county across every state, across the entire nation, which is both the blessing and the curse of our system.
So tell me, like, you know, what's the lay of the land now? I mean, have you guys made some significant, you know, progress? Is there anything, you know, to be excited about or proud of from your work from basically, what, 2006 to now?
Yeah, I think I'm witnessing ongoing progress in the space, which I'm really excited about. You know, those first couple of years after we released that best practices document were discouraging. Like I said, people didn't really even know what to do with the information we were presenting them. But after getting the word out, we simplified the entire document actually into a little set of field guides. Each one of them has 10 tips. You know, one's on ballot design, one's on polling place signage, one's on your voter registration website, whatnot. And they're all full of those same, like, make the type big enough, like, stuff that simple. And it did get to a point where election officials started seeing that and thinking, oh, okay, I understand what that means. Mm-hmm. I know how to implement that. And if, you know, most election officials really do care about making the voting process better for voters, you know. And so a lot of that caught on. And I think there's been a growing movement now where we're seeing a lot more election officials that are reaching out to all kinds of places to say, I want to keep making this better. Where are the resources for me to, you know, now I have a challenge where we've got a special election coming up and it's on a date that our team isn't used to dealing with and the voters don't know is coming up. What's the best way we can get the word out about this? Do we go back to our regular send postcards to everyone? Do we, you know, do a whole new social media push? Do we whatever? All of that kind of stuff where more and more election officials feel like they're thinking, okay, part of what I can do here is keep making this at least incrementally better. How do I keep reaching out and finding the right people to do that? And so it's been exciting to see that more and more of them are really interested in improving that process for voters. And so there's a groundswell, I think, happening where, especially in the modern climate, they want to make the process as clear and easy and transparent and almost delightful as they can to combat, you know, all the stuff that's getting thrown at them from social media.
Wouldn't it be awesome just, like, going to vote and it's just delightful?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's the goal,
that
right?
That probably is my, like, ultimate dream goal.
They're like, oh, it's election day.
Right.
The only thing that would make it worse is if they added one of those CAPTCHA things we have to identify, right? Like a bike or a lamppost or something like that. Don't do that. That's bad. Drew, you seem to be passionate about good design. Is that a fair accusation?
Yeah. Guilty. Guilty starts.
And as we've already kind of talked about, you know, you often don't notice good design until it's not good. And then, you know, we have, you know, contested elections and all kinds of havoc in our world. And you even think about, like, you know, airplanes and automobiles. I know you're a big race car driver. We were just talking about that offline. And, you know, these things, when they're working well, it's just an amazing thing that we just kind of take for granted. And then as soon as something breaks down, then it's like it's in the news or we're going to the shop and we're spending all this money. Can you just talk a little bit to just the power of good design in our society?
Yeah. It's broad. I pause here because I use that term civic design to describe a lot of the things that I do, and there's a whole collection of things that fit under that. But I would say, to oversimplify it, so this isn't an 8-hour podcast, a lot of what I do when I talk about civic design is continuing to build good design that I hope engenders a sense of pride in people, a pride of place, you know, a pride of being connected to those things, a pride of how good this thing is, you know, and it's related to showing off the assets of our state or our city, or, you know, how do we build pride of place? That's definitely a driving force when I talk about civic-minded design. And the other then, as it skews into the elections and ballot design sphere, is good design there, I think, really has the ability to not just make it easier to vote, and maybe one day we get to delightful to vote.
Delightful to vote.
But in the current climate, one of the key things it does is it creates this trustworthiness, right?
Yes.
The good design actually speaks to the trustworthiness of the process. So we've got out in the world, as you're even going to vote, you've got all these messages coming at you, rigged, election fraud, et cetera, right? Where you're like, maybe this system is broken. You know, I don't know. I did hear a story that sounded kind of plausible about XYZ. And I think one of the best roles good design can play in that space is creating a trustworthy environment, giving users a sense that because of the design, it clearly led them through the process. It clearly explained both what's happening on your ballot. So you know, okay, 100% certainty. If I fill in this oval, that means I'm voting for this person. That trustworthiness at its macro level, micro level, and then at a macro level, the trustworthiness around even building voter communications around here's how we collect, count, sort, store, verify all these ballots. So you know that the election's not rigged and everything's going above board, kosher. So, you know, from a small to a big level, design at that space allows us to build this trustworthiness into the system. And I think that's, for me, that's where good design really has its power out in the civic space.
I really just want to commend your work there. I think it is important work in all areas of businesses, you know, nonprofits, and even, you know, with these more like election-based governmental things. But one thing, Drew, that you just mentioned, and I'm glad you brought it up, is kind of your love for place. I feel like Oxide and Drew Davies, these things are kind of synonymous right now. But like, you really just seem to love Nebraska. You seem to, is that right?
Okay, that's true.
Good, yeah. And Omaha in place. And I think we're in a, you know, we're in a time and place where it's easy to move. It's easy to change up our environments and explore the world and travel. But I feel like there's kind of this through line in a lot of your work that just seems very rooted in place. And I thought it'd be fun to talk about some of the things that you've been doing that are very Nebraska. And one of those is the new license plate design. So for those of you living in Nebraska, you either have already gotten this license plate or you're about to get it. I just got mine actually just recently. And the way I want to kind of start this segment is to talk about the last license plate design a little bit that I don't, you didn't do that one, did you? Okay, so there was some controversy around this. Would you mind unpacking that for our listeners? Like, what happened there to your best of your knowledge? And I'd be curious to know, how did you get involved in the new one and the process there?
The last one was a curious story that I feel like I've heard retold in various places across the country throughout time. Maybe it's one of our design ethos stories that just happens forever. But Nebraska has an unusual law on the books where we have to change our license plate every 6 years. I can't find anyone that knows why that law was passed exactly, but that's what we do. Last time that happened, 6 years ago, the well-meaning folks at the state government decided that they would do a design contest of some sort. Now, I call myself a civic-minded designer, so it might seem a little bit strange to have me say a really terrible thing is to accept 1,000 submissions from people and then let everyone vote on them online. But it turns out that in the world of design, I think that probably is not the best way to get.
Yeah, presidents, okay. Right. But not so much design.
You know, it's interesting because there are some factors that go into design that aren't just about aesthetics in terms of like, do I like it or do I not like it? And it tends to be that that's the choice people make. Back to the point at hand, they did accept a variety of submissions. Some committee inside the Capitol somewhere whittled that down to, I want to say, 4 or 5, and then opened up an online voting scenario for those license plates. I would tell you none of them were great anyway, but the folks over at the website College Humor caught wind of the whole thing. They decided one of them was way, way worse than all the others, and they encouraged all their readers from across the nation or wherever to go vote for this, the worst one of these license plates.
I actually did not know that detail. So that's interesting. Okay, so I'm so glad I had you on the podcast.
It won by a landslide because the people that set up the poll didn't even, you know, they didn't think to set it up like, oh, we should make sure it's only Nebraskans voting or it's whatever. So it wins by a landslide. Then before they put everything into action, they catch wind of the fact that it's was probably not legit, whatnot. And so they ended up kind of scrapping the whole set of all those license plates. Someone, I don't know who, developed the basic design format for what happened after that, which is a pretty straightforward Nebraska typeset in blue and gold, which is the state flag colors, and a little silhouette of the sower statue from the top of the state capitol. There was a little bit of extra debacle in that whoever built the original design for that plate found a artwork of the sower online somewhere, put it on the plate, and right before they started printing all of them, they realized that was a different kind of Art Deco styled sower from the state capitol in, I want to say, Michigan.
Yeah, Michigan or Missouri, something like that. It starts with an M. Yeah.
And so they had to do a little about face, Michigan, find the right art, put the sower that's on our state capitol on those license plate, and put them out into the world. Now, it's a state pastime to critique the license plates, maybe because we do them every six years.
Yep.
And so lots of people hated those license plates. Undoubtedly, lots of people love those license plates. I assume some people love those license plates. I don't know. Fast forward 4 years or so into the rest of the process, Suzanne Shore, the wife of the governor, Pete Ricketts at the time, said at that time, I'll take this one. Things didn't go well the last time. So she led the process then for the 6 years later. I knew her through some contacts, so she reached out to Oxide. She reached out to a couple other places and collected a set of submissions from
didn't reach out to us.
Places.
Just have to say. They're like, oh,
maybe you
they
didn't complain enough about the license plates before that.
Hey, we designed the last one. Anyways, back to you.
I had been doing a lot of campaigns online where I'd been floating different designs for license plates and whatnot, so... Yeah, I guess you complain enough and they come to you. So we submitted a variety of things. Really long story short, it went quiet for a long time. I think there was some decision making going on inside the halls of where decisions are
behind,
made.
Yeah, hushed doors.
In the Capitol, I assume. And at a certain point after I hadn't heard about it for a long, long, long time, I heard from them and they said, hey, we've got a sample of that license plate with your design on it. Can we bring it to you and show it to you to make sure it's all kosher? And I thought, this is great.
We won.
That's wonderful. And the design itself, you probably know this because you're also a lover of the Nebraska State Capitol. Yeah. But, you know, given the opportunity to design this license plate, we've had a long string of designs that tend to emphasize the kind of stereotypes about Nebraska, which aren't negative stereotypes, but they're the standard sort of corn and Conestoga wagons and
windmills
and whatnot. And we've had those for a long time. So I thought it was time to do something a little different there, celebrate our state with some pride in a different way. And so the design itself features a mosaic called the Genius of Creative Energy. So this is a mosaic that's on the floor in the state capitol, basically right when you come in the main entrance. It's a 15-foot wide mosaic set into the floor of the state capitol. And it's the start of a whole thematic element that runs through all the art in the state capitol. But the idea
is fantastic.
This is the genesis of creation, right? Mm-hmm. And here's an embodiment of it. The extra cool part is it's actually done by Hildreth Meyer, this not nearly as famous as she should be, artist of the time. She was essentially one of, or if not the only woman working in any of these art spaces at the time. This is the 1920s. This whole space is absolutely dominated by males, but had kind of proven herself out in New York. And so Bertram Goodhue, the architect of the state capitol, reached out and said, I want you to come do all of these mosaics. So a huge amount of the artwork in the capitol is all Hildreth Meyer's work. And the rest of her work is all the stuff on the outside of Radio City Music Hall and all these famous, gorgeous buildings in New York City and whatnot. But she did these murals. So to be able to celebrate this woman way before her time artist and a great piece of art, celebrate the state capitol itself, and show Nebraska in a different light was a great opportunity. So I was so excited that they picked that one. That was the one I really wanted to have happen because it was, and now I hope it serves as this interesting conversation starter, right? When you see that plate, like, you first think, what, Nebraska with this, you know, for those of you who haven't seen it, it's this muscled kind of Romanesque God riding on a cloud, you know, holding lightning bolts with the cosmos behind him.
Not what you typically think of when you close your eyes and think of Nebraska.
Right. And so it's this wild kind of different thing. And it's been fun to think of it as being out there in a world where it does start these conversations. But then I'm hoping people get to say, oh, well, the reason that that's on the Nebraska plate is because it's in the state capitol. And here's why the artwork exists, and oh, you should totally visit the state capitol because if you like this piece, there's a million more.
Right.
All that.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned it, Drew, that we do both share this love of the Nebraska state capitol. And for those who haven't been there, you've got to go. It is so cool. And I guess maybe I haven't been to a bunch of other state capitols, but it's really a cool building with amazing architecture. Amazing artwork all the way throughout. It's super. How tall is it's a really tall building too.
It's 17 stories, something like that. It's hard to gauge because there's a whole bunch of ornamentation, dome and a 17 foot sculpture, the Sower sculpture mounted on top of the building.
It's really worth going and getting a tour, checking out. My kids love it. We've been down there several times. And really just enjoyed, you know, learning the history and just enjoying the beautiful artwork there. I've heard that you're working on a coffee table book about the capital?
Yeah. So
I want to hear more about
realistically,
this.
So this, you know, perhaps civic design begets civic design. After that license plate project, one of the things that, Suzanne Shore was in charge of several projects. She also led a lot of the celebrating the 150th anniversary of statehood project. And then some of that involved celebrating the Capitol and its space. What she determined along the way was that there wasn't really any complete catalog of the artwork of the Nebraska State Capitol, which is unbelievable. It's over 100 years old now. And so this is all artwork that's essentially all built in to the building. It's murals, it's mosaics, it's frescoes, it's whatnot throughout the building. And so when she figured out that there wasn't really a full catalog of that, one of the things she did to help this kind of celebration and pride of place and whatnot is let's catalog all of that.
Wow.
And so that involved actually a lot of drone photography. Some of this stuff is five stories off the floor.
Wow.
You know, where you can't put a bunch of scaffolding up and take photos of it. So they had to do a bunch of drone photography. They had to get some dispensation to fly drones around in the Capitol near all of this 100-year-old artwork. And one time along the way, she made the mistake of accidentally implying maybe all that should be turned into a coffee table book at one point in time. And then I hassled her until she agreed to let me design the coffee table book. I mean, encouraged her that I would love to be involved
project. Right. Hassle is a strong
word. She was kind enough to let me do that. And so we have been working tirelessly on that book. It's been, for me, maybe more exciting than the license plate, just because, you know, you've known it as an adult. I grew up, I spent a bunch of my formative years essentially wandering the Capitol.
Really?
That's a story for a different podcast.
Yeah, I feel like this is a part two.
But I spent a lot of time in my formative years in that Capitol, so I know
I'm picturing just this
pieces.
Like homeless orphan child who just like grew up at this on the steps of the Capitol, and
it was part of my education. But lots of these pieces are, you know, they're burned into my memory as some of the earliest artworks that I know of, and I'm sure they influenced my design style and my aesthetic style. And so to be able to catalog them all in a book, I mean, that's the chance of a lifetime. So we've been building that book, collecting all the artwork, getting it all cleaned up. Suzanne has done a great job writing some backstories, explaining some of how those pieces came to be. So in a lot of ways, this book will be lots of big, pretty pictures of the artwork, but a little bit of context for, you know, why they came to be. And it turns out I didn't even know this until we were working on the book. There's a whole theme that runs through the building, essentially geographically through the building, that's built around these stages. And so the genius of creative energy is at the start of it. That's literally like the origins of everything. The universe happens, and then it builds on itself. And then there'll be another section that's all about, the theme here is, the laws of man. So it's the era in which men started building government and laws and whatnot. And this theme over here is about, you know, the native lands of Nebraska and whatnot, but it all builds into this bigger, broader theme. And we're able to call some of that out in the book and sort of help explain that to people, which is super fun that even just knowing it as a collection of disparate, beautiful artworks, now I know it's actually even built into this huge, big picture that it all kind of comes together. Mm. And it turns out the last parts of it, way up in the tower, there's a memorial chamber at the top tower that's really just a gathering space, and it's right where you go to the windows and you can look out
the top. Right there.
There's a collection of artworks up there that weren't installed until 1996, and it was the last piece of the whole theme that they'd visioned out, and it just hadn't been implemented until, you know, 80 plus years after the building was finished. But it's been a dream to work on that book.
When will that book be available? And is it clear how people can get their hands on it yet?
Yeah, it is at press now.
Oh, wow.
So it should be available by holiday shopping season 2023.
Ooh, there we go.
Grab one for your friends and loved ones.
I'm sure we will share that once it's available. I'll definitely have one for my coffee table. So, Drew, what's next? What's next for you? What's next for Oxide? Anything exciting on the horizon?
Lots more civic design work. The good news is, you know, I've been operating independently now for a year and a half or so, and it's really given me the opportunity to pursue these civic-minded projects that we've been talking about. And so I'm excited to have the opportunity to keep doing more and more of that. So big picture, the most exciting part is that document I mentioned way back when that we developed for the EAC. They just recently reached out, and because of the groundswell of these election officials across the nation looking for more and more resources, but needing to get those resources from a viable, trusted place like the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, they reached out and asked me if I would lead the project of basically building version 2 of this document, the kind of new updated version that steps away from the nuanced 14 over 16 type and moves towards, okay, here's the big picture rules you can follow as you're trying to improve all these materials. And so I couldn't have dreamed that project would show up. It's very exciting, but to get to lead the process and really gather best practices from around the nation, from all these nonprofits and great election officials that are doing perfect things, put them all into one place that then becomes the resource that they can look to. I couldn't have imagined that I would get the opportunity to take another crack at that book and really make it now 15 years later, all the experience I've got, make it into something that's even more valuable, we can better design around elections more and more, especially right now in this time when, you know, they're under attack from a lot of sides.
Hmm. Drew, to kind of wrap things up, I'm trying to think of trying to formulate the perfect question to end on here. But, you know, listening to your story, even before we started recording and now, it seems like, you know, you're kind of in the right place at the right time a few times. But I know that it's not just that. I feel like you're someone who really works to do the right thing. And you can't, I know you were joking about hassling that individual, but like you have this kind of tenacity to you. And I was just curious, if do you have any advice for anyone who wants to make a difference or is maybe inspired to, you know, help in a, you know, a civic arena? Any points of advice for those who are want to make a difference, but maybe feel like, I don't know, stuck?
Right. You know, you may be right about the tenacity. When I look back at a lot of those scenarios, they feel like there's a lot of luck involved. Mm-hmm. But I suppose I believe some of the people that say you make your own luck.
Make your own luck.
For me, that tenacity has come from feeling really strongly about two things. One, like wanting to make a difference in the community, you know, wanting to build that civic pride or to mm-hmm. make those elections better. And also then having a real passion for a pretty specific subject matter. Like there was something about elections that when that first phone call came in and, you know, they were looking for a volunteer to kind of lead the Nebraska effort, my brain lit up and I thought, that is exactly what I would like to be doing with my design skills. And so those two things, I think, for me have combined into that scenario where it means I'm always just by virtue of those things, you know, I'm doing my best work. I'm putting my all into it. I'm being passionate about it. And, you know, from the work you do, people respond to that, you know, when they feel like you're not just phoning it in or you're not just trying to bug them about something because you'll get a giant paycheck out of it.
Right.
You know, they know when you're dedicated because you're passionate about it. And easy for me to say, but the best advice really is, especially in a civic space or even just a community minded design space, you know, find those things that really speak to you, you know, that you feel very passionate about, because those are the spaces where it's not going to be work for you to make it seem like you care. It's not going to be work for you to do the design or to look to solve the problems. So that's core. The other, I would just say tactically, you know, if you're a designer and you see design problems out in the world and you think, oh, I've got design solutions for that, this will be easy. So I would just tell everyone, you know, make sure to go in with some humility and say, you know, find the right people, but talk to them about, I experienced that this may be a design problem. And maybe even, you know, with conversations like, it seems like there'd be an easy solve to this. Look, I whipped up a new ballot over here. It's so much simpler. Like, going with some humility, understanding there are probably a lot of reasons why that design problem exists and why someone hasn't just swooped in and fixed it.
Right.
You know, and know that you're gonna want to listen to a lot of those voices about, yeah, well, here's an intractable problem, and here's a thing that's caused us to not be able to move as far down the road as we wanted to, and whatnot. But you know, step in with some of that. I don't have all the answers, but as a passionate designer, I want to help. So tell me more about this problem, and then I want to use my skills to help you solve it.
That's good advice. I'm feeling so inspired. I really just had you on here to kind of keep me in the game for a few more years. So, Drew, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm very happy to be here.
Very inspired. And yeah, for everyone listening, you know, I love what you were just saying about really trying to find those things that you're really passionate about, being very passionate about them, and then trying to align those with, you know, the things that you do well. And so, very inspired. I hope you are too. Thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Honored to be here. Thanks for having me.
In our last outro, it was just Ben recording the plea for you to like and subscribe, but it made it look like Ben was really desperate, and so I showed up to give him moral support. Please like and subscribe.